This is The Conversation. Hey, I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to The Conversation. We are just past a year old. The show launched on 11-11-11. It's now the 13th of November. So that's the timeline history. Of course, most podcasts that I am familiar with in terms of marking milestones tend to do the 100th episode and whatnot. So we have a ways to go before we're there. I think we're in the high 50s, maybe around 60 episodes at this point. Some have been multiple parters, but as far as guests, there have been about, let's say, call it 60 at this point. So that's where we're at. We've gone a long way. We have a long way to go. And today, for this episode, it's an excellent podcast. So I'm happy to announce with Mikol Ebron and really flowing, great exchange. The conversation wrote itself. You know, listening to it, it was, I can't imagine how it could have gone better, really. Very entertaining, fun, and intense, as I acknowledge at one point towards the end. So you will hear all that. Before we get to that, let's cover a couple of things. First of all, if you do like this conversation with Mikol, then please do social media it out there. You know, I'm doing my best with the social media, the Twitter and the Facebook and what have you, to spread the word. But if you like it, if you're happy with it, if you're excited about it, put your own social networks to use, the Facebooks, the Twitters, the Tumblrs, whatever else you might use to grow the numbers. I think this one deserves to get a lot of numbers. Recent numbers have been a little disappointing, so any way you can help would be appreciated. And if you like the show and listen regularly or often, I know you cherry pick. I want to thank, especially, I know there are a few of you out there who have listened to every episode or just about every episode, and I applaud and thank you. I know the rest of you are cherry picking. You know, I can't control that, but I would listen to episodes of people you don't know, just to throw that out there again. But meanwhile, if you really enjoy this one, put it out there, get those numbers up for this episode, because this particular exchange really deserves those numbers. And other ways that you can support, you can, of course, as I was saying, if you do listen to this show and like it and you have not become a fan on Facebook, please do that and follow as well on Twitter at Artist Podcast. You can contact the show, The Conversation Art Podcast at Gmail. And the donations have been a little slow lately, so if you would like to lend a little support, it can be a small donation. Anything is appreciated. You know, try to give back a little bit if you are a regular listener. Go to the conversationartistpodcast.podomatic.com and you will find a PayPal button there. You can also send checks. Checks are fine as well. Just contact the conversation Gmail address and you can get the contact info that way. So let's see, what else? Oh, by the way, that intro music is a theme that I am now using. It was made by Danny Tull, the artist. And you can share your thoughts on it via any of the various networks. You can contact him if you know him and tell him how great it is. You know, whatever you want to do. You can offer some constructive criticism if you like. But, you know, any feedback would be appreciated. What else? You know, I think the point is that a little more dialogue with the show. I'm sure that I could be tweeting more and, you know, get things going that way. But, you know, any kind of commentary, getting a conversation going on Facebook, etc., is very much appreciated. So, you know, if you want to take 5 seconds and write a comment and, you know, respond to other people's comments or what have you, that would be fantastic. All right, so why don't we get on over to the conversation with Mikol Ebron. And by the way, that was kind of my impression of what her name sounded like. You might, if you don't know her, you'll find out something slightly different. So let's get to that now. Thank you for coming along, and thank you for sticking with the show. And I will talk to you later.
With
how I want to start things off, is I want to do a reveal for people who don't know you or don't know much about you, because Nicole Hebron, is that, tell me how you pronounce your name.
Nicole, yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Nicole.
Is not Israeli.
Correct.
And so when they hear you talk, they might be a little surprised if they don't know who you are.
Well, did I tell you where my name comes from? You like
you
to
started
talk about
to,
names,
but tell me again.
Yeah. So it comes from the movie The Garden of the Finzi Continis, where the heroine is named Nicole, and it's about a family of Italian Jews in the midst and wake of World War II, and Nicole is the heroine. And my father was an art movie buff his whole life, so as a teenager, he used to sneak away to the art house movie theaters, ditching class with his best friend and like watch, you know, Godard films. And so my parents saw that movie and just loved the name. It was really as simple as that.
So you pronounce it Nicole, mm-hmm. kind of like the French Nicole.
Correct.
As opposed to Nicole.
Yeah. It sounds like you have a cold when you use the schwa sound. McCole. Like, it sounds like a little kid with a cold. it's ugly.
And what kind of name is Hebron?
Well, Hebron is, of course, a place, and I'm told that authentic Jewish names don't take places as names unless you're an immigrant. So we don't actually know the origin of our name, except that there's speculation that that there's ancestors of ours in Ireland who had originally immigrated from Jordan or the West Bank, or we don't know.
Is your father's ancestry Irish?
No, yeah, he's Irish. Uh-huh. So, like, we're Irish Catholic, totally. Alcoholics and the whole bit. Yeah.
What about your mom?
My mother comes from... I don't know. I mean, I like to say that I'm fifth generation white trash. We can... which I really am. Like, we can trace our lineage on my mother's side back to pilgrims on the Santa Maria. So we've been in New England for a long time.
But that's not the opposite of white trash, isn't it? Isn't that, like...
We devolved into white trash. No. Which is probably really mean to say, but we're very like lower middle class New Englanders.
So your parents came from New England?
Both of them, yeah.
What part?
My mother is from Rhode Island. Well, she was born in New York and raised in Rhode Island, and then my father is from Queens.
And then they had you in Northern California?
Yeah.
Where?
They both came to California. You know, not explicitly for the summer of love, but in that time, you know, they both kind of ran away from home lives that they didn't like as 20-somethings seeking, you know, a better utopian life in California, as everyone has done towards the West.
My parents left the East Coast to come to California.
Yeah, what year?
Early 70s.
Yeah. They came out in 69, I think. And they both met in San Francisco at the Shandy Gaff restaurant. My mother was a waitress. My father was a chef.
Nice.
Chatting.
What's
over
the Shandy
counter.
Gaff?
It was a super fancy restaurant at the time. I don't think it's still around.
Right. Well, your dad's running off and watching Godard films, so he's obviously trying to get away from white trash as far as possible.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, he was really smart about art and culture.
So you had a really good influence that way.
They were both very creative. Yeah, for sure. My father was a classical violinist, kind of hobbyist violinist, and has an incredible knowledge about music. Like, he can listen to any piece of music, like classical music, and tell you what piece it is, probably who the conductor is, and who the, like, you know, first violinist. It's like he has an amazing ear. Yeah.
So, is there a practical application for that if you're not a music professor?
No, I don't think so.
Did he have a separate profession then?
He's a chef.
Oh, that's right.
Still.
Wow.
Always, yeah.
What kind of places he could have been a chef at?
Right now, he's a private chef for a rich family in Beverly Hills. But
So he's down here now?
Yeah, he's
down
here.
Is your mom too?
No, my mother passed away in 92.
I'm sorry.
So, thank you. She died of cancer at a time where had she had the same cancer now, she would have survived for sure. You know, it's like kind of amazing to see. How
what kind of
medicine
cancer
is. She had lymphoma that then came back as breast cancer and came back everywhere, actually. Came back brutally and rapidly and really ferociously.
Wow. So when your mother passed, did that bring you closer to your father then?
Ooh, good question.
Because now that he's in the same town as you?
Not really.
Is that a coincidence?
No, they split up when I was really little. So they separated when I was 1 or 2 years old. And then at a very confused, they're hippies. Like, they got back together and not, and then, it was back and forth for a long time. But they never were really... I didn't grow up in a two-parent household. I was definitely a child of separated parents.
Did you go back and forth?
Yeah, all the time. Summers I spent with my mother, and I lived with my father most of the time until I was a teenager, and then I lived with my mother.
Wow. How do you think that has impacted your psychology? I mean, obviously, there are too many ways to count, but I mean... Do you have a pat answer for that?
No, I don't have a pat answer for that. My father was an alcoholic, and that had a huge impact on me. My mother was a workaholic, and that also had an impact on me. And I was a classic latchkey kid, so I would walk myself home from school starting from grade 2. So there was a sense of independence and a sense of self-reliance that started really early. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I didn't expect much from parents in that regard.
Something that's coming up in my mind is whether that independence connects to your post or your feminist or your post-feminist perspective.
I've been asked that in terms of my mother, right? Did my mother have an influence on that? And we didn't ever really talk about that stuff when she was alive, interestingly. Feminism wasn't a conscious topic, it was implicit in that she never did, she never wore makeup, she never did her hair, she wasn't fashion-y, she was a hippie and very kind of down to earth and, not superficial at all. So it was a point of frustration for me as an adolescent because I wanted to know how to do my hair and dress cool and be hip and cute and whatnot. And I didn't have any siblings, and my mother had none of that was on her radar at all. So, and certainly my father wasn't going to go there with me. So I feel like I had this really awkward, induction into puberty and, the throes of high school and trendiness and aesthetics and whatnot. So my sense of self was predicated more on my really quirky independent impulses that occurred to me, and was defined by performativity and by I guess performativity is the best word.
What were the earliest incarnations of performativity for you?
I can tell that's a word you don't like.
No, I don't mind it. I like it better than practice a lot. What I'm curious about is that sounds like it came up pretty early.
Really early. So when I was little, my parents lived in Marin County and in Mendocino, and I went back and forth between the two. We weren't on a compound in Mendocino, but there were several families living around on the same land together. And you would kind of go over to so and so's dad and hang out with their family for a while and whatnot. And we always did really kind of quirky things there. And what I remember it started out as an April Fool's joke, but then it became kind of a regular thing to, dye the milk blue or green, just, for fun. And then that translated into, dyeing mashed potatoes different colors. And, we had a lot of imaginative play in the forest. And most of the friends that I have now who are, incredible computer scientists or engineers or... rocket scientists or whatnot, I found out, grew up in tiny towns, in backwoods or in the country, and had to figure shit out themselves. They took stuff apart and they created their own entertainment. So
performance was a form of entertainment for you?
Kind of. I mean, so the first performative things, that was maybe an early creative thing with the dye, but the first performative things that I recall and really distinctly were... starting around age 4, maybe, I had a really special dance that I would do for visitors to our house, which I called the butt dance. And if a visitor came to our house that I liked, I would drop my pants and sort of shimmy around and stick my butt out and show them my butt. as a welcome gesture, really. And if I didn't like them, I would hide behind my mother's legs and growl at them. These are performances that I continue today. No, I'm kidding.
Well, we were just, I have to go on a, instinctive train of thought, because before we got on mic, we were talking about Klaus, your dog, who has been... become a barometer for healthy men. So I'm wondering if your butt dance was somehow
the butt barometer.
The same effect.
Yeah, undoubtedly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would usually perform the butt dance for boyfriends of my mother's that I liked, and the ones I didn't like, that they got growled at.
Wow.
You know.
It's all coming full circle.
It is. I also used to like to wear tails to school a lot.
So what was your reputation as a kid, do you think?
I have no idea. I mean, I was really little. I was like 4 or 5 and okay. 6, so I don't know what my reputation
was. So everybody, all kids were quirky back then?
Maybe, but I mean, I wouldn't know what other people said about me. I mean, I went to a Montessori school, and it was very open and forgiving. And
sure.
I do remember my mother telling me that she and my father had this attitude of letting me do whatever I wanted to do to express myself, and I discovered blue eyeshadow at one point. I don't know if it was hers or what, and I decided that I would wear blue eyeshadow to school all the time, still as a 4 or 5 or 6 year old. And I also really hated brushing my hair, so I'd have really big rat's nesty hair and blue eyeshadow and a tail. I'd show up to school. And I really liked school and would complain and, like, make a fuss when my parents came to pick me up. So my mother told me at one point that they had garnered a reputation of, you know, not providing a happy home life because I would come to school with, like, rat's nests in my hair and blue eyeshadow, and I didn't ever want to go home. And she was a little embarrassed about that because it was at that point they started imposing hair brushing.
The beginning of the end.
Yeah, which I still hate. And I did, you know, so I guess that performativity carried through my whole school life. Like, I wore crazy, wacky vintage clothes all the time, and for a while, maybe out of secondary school, but in college, like, I really liked wearing fake bruises. And would, like, sort of perform, like, having been beat up. I was in college, I guess, at that point, so I wasn't dating my parents anyway, but
right.
I did a lot of theater in high school, too. So, and I don't think I was very good at it, but I liked it a lot. And then I eventually discovered kind of performance in college, but I was looking for it in high school, I think, with theater. And I was a pianist, so I performed in that way, but I hated performing as a pianist.
Like recitals?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Why did you hate it?
I don't know. I didn't play for anyone. I didn't want to play for anyone else. I wanted to play for myself. It was meditative. Say it was a practice.
So there's this clear thing that's coming through with these items from your past is that you were engaging in performative acts, but you weren't looking for attention.
Correct.
It's such an interesting,
totally,
paradox.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't want attention. It was just, I was inhabiting them, but it wasn't for an audience at all.
At some point, I knew that I was going to have to bring up Marina Abramović's recent performance. I just saw the documentary, you know, about the show at MoMA, and particularly the performance just last weekend, and so I knew talking to you I was going to want to bring it up at some point, and I think this is as good a point as any, because one of the more interesting things about that documentary, did you see it?
I haven't
okay.
seen it.
Okay. Well,
heard about it. But
well, I'm not going to, you know, give anything away. I'm just going to tell you that she had a very sort of stern, unforgiving mother, and a big part of her performance life comes out of wanting the public's love. Basically, that's a big part of her career, as it turns out. Whereas you, even though you were a latchkey kid, that didn't seem to be an issue for you, and you were doing these performances out of some, I don't know, aesthetic is obviously not the right word, but out of satisfying some kind of more personal need than love.
Oh, sure, yeah, I think that's accurate. I think that I was pretty self-conscious pretty early on, and any directed attention made me nervous. Because I expected criticism, I think. Right?
Why?
So directed.
Why is that?
My father was pretty critical, for sure. You know, when he was drinking, everything, nothing was right. Like, there's nothing, I couldn't do anything that was right. So, you try to be as kind of quiet and silent and invisible as possible.
Wow.
And performing, I think, provides a transformation of sorts and a means of exploration, but it was different for me than theatricality, too. Like, I wasn't taking up fictional characters. I wasn't enacting someone else or scripted things. And, in fact, my performances now, I really avoid anything scripted or repeated.
Yeah.
Because I think it becomes too theatrical when that happens. So, but I don't know. I never thought about it in terms of attention one way or another. And I think artists in general are garnering attention, right? They're calling that you have to have an audience in order to be an artist of any sort. You want people to look at what you do. So I think my performances are not as much about calling attention to myself as they were about fulfilling fantasies or a question about some aspect of myself or expressing an alternative part of me or an alternative perspective that I couldn't do in kind of everyday living. I've always been interested in why we do what we do on a daily basis, like why we engage in certain behaviors or protocol, how we learn those things and how implicit they are sometimes.
What would you say the ratio of the performances you've done are in front of an audience versus maybe less so or not?
Oh, that's an interesting question. 50-50.
The one that I keep thinking of that I kind of want to go to give people a specific want to think about is the one, the gold, what's the gold one called, where you're wearing gold and you're sitting on top of this cascading gold.
That's called Walhor.
Walhor, okay.
It's copper.
Got it, copper, okay. In the reproduction, looks a little gold, but in any case, you're sitting up on top of this, like, 8-foot platform with a copper thing cascading down from it, and you're peeing on it?
Correct. Yeah, it was a wall.
Okay.
And a wall in a gallery, and it was a public performance. And I was peeing, and I sat on top of the wall for...
But you weren't nude.
No, I wasn't nude. I was wearing colors that matched the color of the copper in that case. It wasn't about nudity. I think a lot of times people think performance artists are just about getting naked in public.
No, that's clearly not your MO for the most part. But I just wanted to make sure that people envision the piece...
Yeah, okay. I was close. So I was wearing sort of a turquoise top, which was the color of copper when it oxidizes, and then a copper skirt that matched the copper.
Right.
And I invited visitors to feed me drinks that were like water or iced tea. I had a bunch of beverages down at the bottom of the wall, and so people could walk up and offer me something to drink, and as long as they fed me things to drink, I would drink them, and then whenever they made it through my body, as the moment occurred to me, I would pee.
How long were you up there?
Down the wall. 4 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there was an endurance element.
Yeah, a little bit. That piece was very much about body time. And I'm really interested in body time. The things that your body does or the processes that your body undergoes that you don't have control over. Like, you can only force yourself to pee so quickly, right? Like, you can't drink something and then make yourself pee faster. Like,
right.
It's going to take as long as it takes to get through your body, and I'm really interested in that. And I think we try so hard to control the timing of our lives in so many other ways that there are certain physiological things that we just can't control, or certain limits that our bodies have that we don't have control over. And you can maybe train yourself to stretch those limits, but... I don't usually train myself. I think it's really important to engage in the capacities that my body has just naturally as I am, as I live, as I do my day-to-day business. So that piece, I would pee whenever I had to, And it became, the peeing became an event. So it became this, like, that became this, the moment of performance, like when it actually came out of my body. And a really amazing thing happened during that performance. It was during Perform Now, maybe the first Perform Now in Chinatown. And there were intermittent crowds of people coming in and out of the gallery. And one guy stood there for a really long time, maybe 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And he was looking at me, like trying to figure out what I was doing. And he kind of heard from other people that maybe I was peeing. And after a while, he finally looked at me and he said, "Well, can you pee now?" And I said, no, I'm not ready to pee now. And he's like, "Oh, well, can you just tweet me when you're ready to pee?" He didn't want to wait anymore.
That's brilliant.
And, which I thought was so, and I was really pissed off, pun intended, at the time. But the more I think about it, the more I thought it's really brilliant. Like, I was frustrated that he didn't want to wait. Like, they didn't get that the waiting was part of it. Like, the whole process was part of it. But I also loved that he had just latched on to, like, the peeing as the moment. Like, as
How old
the
was
event.
This guy?
He was an adult. I don't know. Like, 30s.
Wow. That's awfully anti-precocious of him.
Oh, yeah. He was just like, "I'm over this. Like, you're wasting my time. Just give me a tweet. Come on. Yeah, let's get on with this."
Wow. Well, what I wanted to ask, I'm glad I brought up this particular performance, obviously, now, but what occurred to me is, you know, you explained this very articulately, the structure of, you know, the approach about, you know, recognizing and control and whatnot, but underneath all of that, there's the shame element, too, right? Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, that the wall whore piece came out of another piece that I had done in 2005, and I don't have an official name for it. I think I called it student or classmate or something. And I was asked by a student of mine at the time to be in a show that he was producing. And it was at a time when people were still really recognizing me for the Fountains performance, which it was a video piece where I vomited the rainbow, basically. And it was very sensationalized once it made it to the public, and I became kind of known for that, right?
Like, how did you vomit the rainbow? Just for people's edification.
Well, it was one color at a time. It was a 6-channel video piece, and each channel, I was wearing a different color. And I was wearing a monochromatic outfit, so I'd wear all red, and then I would sit there looking at the camera, and I'd vomit red repeatedly. And so on for all the colors of the rainbow, and it was structured so that it created a color wheel in the room. So it was projected on all four walls of a room, creating this color wheel that rotated around. It was sort of an Albers-esque color study, and I was thinking about painting, how to express ideas of painting through video. And I was also thinking about the role of the artist as one who just barfs up ideas or is expected to just purge themselves of creativity all the time whenever they're making something. And I grew up with an autoimmune disease called Crohn's disease, which affects the digestive system. So I was just constantly made aware of the internal workings of my body, but it was never visible to anyone else. So that piece for me was this kind of apt metaphor for the inside and the outside, the aesthetics of the inside and the outside, both physically and metaphorically. And this student asked me to be in a show, and he was doing a show about red. He's like, "It's the red show, and, you know, I thought maybe you could do something." And I knew that he wanted me to, like, vomit red, like some sort of vaudevillian actor, like the Blue Man Group or something. And I was pretty annoyed at that, because it was a complete dismissal of, like, the entire rest of my body of work. And so as a result, I thought about the student... I thought about the student-teacher dynamic and what that meant and the power play in that. And I came up with a piece that involved me sitting on a chair. I was wearing an all-red dress, a shirt dress, and I was sitting on a chair that was mounted to one of the beams of this loft. So it was about 10 feet up on the beam. And below my chair, it was a school desk chair. It was like an old-school oak school desk chair. And then below my chair, there was another chair at ground level that anyone could sit in if they wanted. And knowing that it was a student-produced show, it would be mostly students at the show. Anyone who sat in that chair was likely to be a student. So here I would be sitting above them, this hierarchical relationship of teacher-student. But as with Walhor, I was drinking red liquids in this case, and people could feed me red drinks, Gatorade mostly. And as it occurred to me, I would pee, in this case, wetting myself, wetting my dress, and the pee would seep down from my chair directly onto the chair below me. So it references sort of fetishistic golden showers thing. It references very sexual thing, because you could kind of see right up my dress if you're positioned at the right point down below, playing upon these sort of teacher fantasies. And then this kind of repulsive / sexual thing would happen as I would... And for the most part, people caught on and nobody sat in the chair, but one guy was drunk enough that he didn't notice and he sat in the chair.
The guy, the student, former student who asked you to be in the show, and then the guy who said, tweet me when you're going to pee, just makes me wonder, certainly begs the question, how often is your performance or just performance, you know, either misunderstood or just sort of, you know, falsely contextualized, you know, into, you know, the school of popular entertainment?
A lot.
Blue Man Group school.
Yeah, that's happened both individually and with the LA Art Girls. And I think it maybe happens less now with my individual performances because I've grown to have a better understanding about how to contextualize my work and how to control its reception. I did a piece called Auto Pleasuring where I went around Los Angeles sexually harassing people's cars and made video of it, and that became this weird fetishy cult thing online, and I got really strange emails from people.
It was on YouTube?
All or? Over, uh-huh, yeah, for uh-huh. a while it was on YouTube. I stopped putting things on YouTube after that, after Fountains and after Auto Pleasuring. I stopped putting things on YouTube because I got so many obnoxious, quote, fans.
But they're just sending comments, right?
They would track me down and email me sometimes.
Because you had your name attached.
Yeah. Or they'd send me comments. And in fact, with Fountains, I was propositioned to do vomiting for pay, which was one of the more interesting and more offensive propositions I received. And some guy, I got a lot of vomit fetishes from that, which was really disturbing to me. Because my piece was not about bulimia, but it clearly played upon that. Like, the response that people had went there. And these guys who were interested in seeing girls throw up as a sexual thing became really upsetting. And yeah. One guy offered to hire me. He's like, oh, I really want to pay you to do this for me. And so I entertained his, I was curious to see where he was going. I would never do it, but I was curious to see what he would say. And I said, oh yeah, how much? And he said, well, what would you charge? And I said, well, I don't remember the order of things actually, but I told him that the video was like $1,500. And he's like, oh, well, I was going to give you $100. And I thought, you're like, fuck you, dude. But he wanted me to eat as much McDonald's as I could and then throw up for him for $100.
And
I said, well, I'm a vegetarian and my video's like, you know, $1,500, so no. But my boyfriend at the time was reading these emails with me and he said, tell him I'll do it. I'll eat as much as he wants. So I offered for this guy that my boyfriend would be happy to oblige if he wanted.
That
fortunately that ended that conversation.
Right. Oh man, you blew his fantasy. I wonder if with the combined elements of these vomiting performances, if you will, if there's a shamanistic element for anorexics and bulimics and what have you.
I don't know. I don't know that I feel qualified to talk about that. Like,
right.
it really, really, truly wasn't about that. And I was very conscious to create aesthetics that didn't give those indicators, right? They had nothing to do with me sticking my finger down my throat or you didn't see me eating anything. Like, it was very much about this kind of magical expulsion and about the color of what came out matching my external outfit exactly. Like, it was really, it really was about aesthetics.
Yeah.
And it was about my own, you know, on a personal level, it was about my own disease with Crohn's, and it was about thinking about how much we feel in on the interior, and none of that is visualized externally. But Fountains was truly about painting. Like, it was very much about painting, and this the primacy of painting in the art world. And what does one do as a young female performance and video artist in grad school when the legacies that you hear about over and over are still rooted in painting? And I thought, okay, well, if I have to talk about painting, like, how would I talk about painting in a medium that is familiar to me? So that's what came out. And it was a series of three videos that I did about painting through video. And another piece called Pisces Climactica that was about using beta fish to explore abstract expressionism. And I'm still wrestling with the legacy of painting. So
yeah, these, you have like, some paintings in your studio.
Yeah. And Walhor was like a spoonerism of Warhol and this idea of the ready-made and the body as a ready-made and the body as a paintbrush, like per Eve Klein, and these ephemeral marks made permanent. And...
But let's get to the sensational element of it all. How did you, what? I'm just curious what some of the consequences or what went down with some of your more provocative performances, like, because you've done at least a few performances confronting people in public and whatnot. Is that about accurate?
Which ones are you thinking of?
Well, I know that there was one that you were where there was activity on the street. I can't remember.
Oh yeah, there have been a few.
Yeah, that's what I'm referring to.
Okay, yeah, I'm interested in interactivity for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And you say provocative, and I immediately think of like the extra sexualized ones that people perceive. But those are more videos and not performance.
Yeah. I just mean, am I falsely categorizing, you know, some of the public, non-planned, as it were, you know, unannounced performances that you did?
Oh, I think sensational and provocative are interesting words. They're not words that I think about when I construct the works at all. I'm interested in disrupting normative behaviors or expectations, but I don't think that I've ever done a piece because I wanted to be provocative in that sense, or because I wanted to be sensational. I am interested in the visual impact that a performance can make. And I think that's something that like Suzanne Lacy and Marina Abramović have taught me really clearly, that even though you might be engaging in a performative act, there will be images that result from that, right? They are historicized through images, through singular images. And so if a performance or an artwork doesn't leave an indelible image, then it's forgotten, except for those who experienced it directly. And so you talk about pieces where I'm on the street, and the first thing that comes to mind is the piece that I did in Scotland in 2008. And I did a piece called The Kindness of Strangers. And, well, there are two pieces, The Kindness of Strangers and Love Thy Neighbor. And Love Thy Neighbor was directly in the streets, and I walked through the streets of Scotland wearing an American flag and nothing else, and carrying a stack of DVDs of my video art. And
now we have to at least establish that it is you could very easily categorize that as provocative. Whether or not
sure,
you were intending
that
can
be an
so.
Adjective applied to it, but that wasn't the inspiration or impetus for the piece.
No, but I think what my sort of what I was getting at, so just so you don't misunderstand where I'm coming from, is on a vernacular or on just a casual observer kind of perspective, I just want to know, and I think people would be curious to know, when you go out and, you know, fuck with the public, you know, there's some shit that's going to happen. And I guess I just want to know, you know, has everything just gone, you know, perfectly smoothly, and it was as if you were at a perform, you know, you were at the the Scotland, the alternative festival in Scotland, in Edinburgh, the Edinburgh Festival. You know,
oh,
it was
no,
like
this,
that, the Fringe Festival.
No, this was part of the National Review of Live Art, which was at the time the longest running performance art festival.
Oh, so it was a performance context.
It was in a performance context, though I was outside of the venue for sure.
Okay.
So
that's, I mean, see, that's a really important angle to acknowledge, you know.
Well, it is, but none of the people that encountered me on the street knew that. They didn't know that it was part of that.
No, yeah, that's my point. My point is that when you do a performance that's outside of a performance context, uh-huh. you know, there is maybe we should go back. I should go back and erase the words provocative and sensational, and just use the word confrontational.
Oh no, I'm not confrontational. Definitely not.
But if you're going, I take your point. But if you're walking through the street or whatever you were doing, wearing an American flag, and people see you, they're either going to do the, let's just look at it from the perspective of the civilian. They're either going to go into this, oh fuck, get away, you know, I want to run away from this, uh-huh. or oh, what's going on?
Right. Yeah, I was met with a lot of hostility. Because in 2008, America was not seen favorably in Europe at all. To say the least. And
people, well, actually, 2004 would have been worse, but
right,
in any case.
That's true.
Yeah.
People swore at me, they spat at me, they yelled at me, they drove by in their cars back and forth yelling and screaming, which sort of surprised me. And then a bunch of little kids, like, threw rocks and stuff at me, which was kind of intense.
Wow.
Yeah. I ended up in the Pakistani neighborhood of Scotland, trying to convince people to trade my art DVDs for clothes. My idea was that I was going to function as a cultural ambassador. Like, I wanted to engage in a gesture that returned art to a different kind of value system than the capitalist market that we see in art fairs or galleries. That I wanted to think about art. Kind of maybe even in pre-colonial or even colonial times, where this exchange of artistic artifacts was a way of learning about another culture, and a way of sharing kind of cultural or personal experience. And so I thought if art is my capital, then I would try to use my videos as money. And I would walk the streets asking to exchange, you know, my art for the things that I needed until I got them. I also was really interested in getting a Scottish flag. I wanted to trade the American flag for a Scottish flag, and I learned two really interesting things. One is that no one over there wanted anything to do with the American flag, but also nobody had Scottish flags. Like, our kind of patriotic narcissism is so unique to America, which I should have assumed. I guess I just never really thought.
I don't
about.
Know. I'm sure that might be the case with Scotland, but there are definitely a ton of nationalistic countries that do go nuts with their flags.
Right. Scotland's not one of them.
Apparently
so
not.
Nobody had a Scottish flag.
That's
at
a good
all.
Point, because I mean, like, if you asked 100 people, you know, can you identify the colors of a Scottish flag? Most of them would say no.
So.
But anyway.
So, yeah, so no one had one. I ended up giving it away to an Italian, young Italian student who was squatting at the performance festival because he was so desperate to see performance. He had come up from Venice to check out the performance work and didn't have anywhere to stay, and he was using the flag basically as a blanket. And I came to find later that he was this incredible and really famous dancer who like was touring the world with his dance troupe and actually came to UCLA Live like a couple of years after that. This is really funny.
I kind of pictured you the way you were describing your sojourn earlier, that you went into this Pakistani section of Edinburgh, was it?
Scotland. At Glasgow.
Glasgow.
Uh-huh.
So I pictured you, you know, and this is where the stone started in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
I pictured you with this flag basically getting as far away from the performance festival as you could, literally and figuratively, and it was like, okay, now how do I get out of here alive, kind of
Yeah, it was pretty intense. I mean, it was in March, and it was about 43 degrees, so
wow.
It was really cold. And I didn't know the neighborhood, and I didn't have GPS. I didn't really know where I was going.
And you didn't have a handler or what have you?
I had a cameraman who was trailing
me. Okay.
So that was, I mean, which I'm always apprehensive about, because I think as soon as someone sees a camera or someone documenting, they know, you know, that there's something going on.
Yeah.
He stayed out of it entirely. Like, he really didn't intervene at any point. But I think people could still see, you know, if they paid attention, they could notice him across the street or behind me somewhere. But other than those, guys, those kids, the encounters I had were amazing. Like, I encountered some guy sitting on his stoop, and he had seen me going, knocking door to door at one point. I stopped approaching people on the street, and when I got into a more residential neighborhood, and I just went door to door, knocking on the doors and explaining to them what I was doing. And he had seen me across the street, and he says, "Hey, come over here." And I walked over to him, and he said, "What are you doing?" In a really thick accent. And I said, "Well, I'm doing this performance piece and trying to exchange my art for clothes." And he went into his house. He sort of grunted and went into his house for a long time and then came back out and presented me with his mother's sweater. And his mother had died a few years before. And he said, "I don't really get what you're doing, but I think she would get it. And
wow,
you should have this." And he was, like, he worked in a mine nearby. Like, it was amazing. Like, really poignant, amazing gestures. And another woman invited me into her house, and she was so excited that I was doing this thing that was cool and weird, and she basically gave me free rent of her entire closet. She said, "Just pick what you want. This is so great. I love it. Just take whatever you think." And let me just pick a dress, and I ran into a junkie who was, like, straight out of Train Spotting with, like, rotting teeth and worms crawling out of his gums and, like, a crazy raving girlfriend, and they were high as fuck on meth or heroin or whatever. And he tried to offer me his soccer shirt, and his girlfriend started freaking out and coming at me because that was a shirt that she had given him as a gift. And
Dear.
He wasn't allowed to give it to me. And so instead he offered me his really nasty athletic socks.
Wow.
That I put on, walked around in.
Oh, yeah. So that was the most painful part of the
performance. That was the hardest part of the performance. That was after asking me if he could jerk off to my videos because he thought they were porn. And I said, "Well, you could try if you want. I don't know."
Wow. So yeah. It's the ridiculous and the sublime
totally
all commingling
every time.
Yeah,
like and the other performance I did there involved inviting people to engage me in a performative exchange, precisely because I was tired of performance as entertainment and performance as like vaudeville, like you know, like this sort of song and dance showy thing, and I didn't want it to be this just kind of free entertainment. I wanted it to really truly be an interpersonal exchange. And so I put several index cards on a wall of all the performances that I would perform for someone if they wanted, these singular performances that were all about intimacy. They were all about offering something personal or intimate or vulnerable. And they and then there was a wall of blank index cards next to that, and each visitor was invited to pick one of my proposed performances and to pick a blank card and to offer a performance of their own in exchange. And that was the most validating and encouraging and amazing performance I've ever done. So I had
where was that?
That was also at the same festival in Glasgow in Scotland, and I re-performed it at 18th Street in Santa Monica. It's the only performance I've done twice. And each time people offered me really amazing things. Like someone sang me an aria, and someone danced for me, and someone else offered to synchronize their heartbeats with me and laid on top of me with his heart on top of my heart until we both agreed that our heartbeats were synchronized. This total stranger, you know, for like half an hour laying on top of me. Like, unbelievable. Like, really, it sounds really cheesy, but it was really intimate and moving. And intimate not in a sexual way. Like,
right.
I'm interested in, like, what does intimacy mean if it's not sexually charged, but just this kind of one-on-one understanding.
So just to clarify, were you offering as your performance, as your gift to them, that you were, your performance included whatever their performances were?
No, I would do my own performance.
What was your performance?
For that one, I don't remember. There were all different kinds of performances. So I would perform a primal scream, or I would give them a massage, or I would listen to their problems, or I would hold their hand for 5 minutes, or I would give them a conciliatory hug, or, you know, they were all very, I would cuddle with them, or I would tell them a story. I would reveal to them my greatest insecurities, like things like that.
So you work, listening to these performance stories. You work in obviously all the media, basically. But I want you to be honest. If you had the choice from, you know, the beginning, would you only do performance, do you think?
If I had the choice to, like, not do...
To be a, like, a Marina Abramović, virtually.
Probably, yeah.
That's what I'm getting, you know, because these performances seem to be the most satisfying kind of thing that you would do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I learn them. I feel like I learn the most from them, and I grow the most when I do them, and I get the most empathic responses from my viewers or participants.
Yeah,
And they're the scariest, maybe. Like I, they're really scary.
I'm so glad. I'm glad you use that word. You know, because what I just was thinking about and wanting to ask you is, you know, you mentioned about how, when you were, you know, growing up as a kid, that you were both performing, but you also kind of didn't want to be seen at the same time. This paradox. Right. And so you're doing that now as an adult. And I'm always interested in this introvert, extrovert kind of thing. And, you know, like Rye Rocklin, who I talked to recently, we kind of agreed that he's kind of in the middle, on the fence between those two things. It kind of seems you're kind of on the fence too.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I think that's accurate.
So you're like, you're really putting yourself out there, but at the same time, you're kind of like, you know, I need a little bit of space at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's art. Art is that space, though, right? As soon as you put something into a form, into another form, whether it's performance or video or whatever, that provides a buffer of a sort. Though I am interested in that, like, where is the line between just actuality,
right,
and representation or form, or performance? I mean, there are certainly videos that I've made that are, I feel are really effective and really poignant, that that usually involve a performative act that is recorded for a video. I think that for me the best indicators of a good piece are the pieces that scare the shit out of me to think about, or the pieces that make me laugh out loud with this thought of, like, holy shit, I could never do that, you know, for whatever reason. It's either too absurd or too crazy or too wacky or too intense or too outside the norm or whatever it is, too outside my comfort zone. Or, you know, like, I think laughter and fear are kind of intimately related sometimes. But those two, those are my indicators. Like, I know that if I think of a performance piece and it sort of terrifies me, that's absolutely the piece I should do.
Does something come to mind when you mention those occurrences?
Most of my pieces, right? The most recent one was the piece I did in Berlin called It's All I Know. And that was a piece where I stood in a plaza in Berlin and recited everything that I knew until my body collapsed.
How did you come up with a list of everything you knew?
That's the point, right? So it's about how you know what you know and how you recall what you know and how you're identified by what
you
know.
That sounds terrifying to do even when you're by yourself.
Yeah. Well, and as a teacher and as an artist and as a bibliophile, like my whole world is about information and knowledge gathering and this sort of love-hate relationship with the collection of knowledge. And I feel like, particularly in academia, you're constantly being asked to prove what you know. And history constantly wants to recognize people for what they know, or what they display they know. And I love the idea that the brain doesn't really abide by these rules of lists or indices or archives or tables of contents. Like, it's this whole jumble, and like so many different things can come up in an hour or 6 hours or 8 hours. But also this connection between the mind and the body, where, like, the more tired you are, the more stressed you are, the more exhausted you are, you recall different things or you forget different things, and you have a different sense of what your body of knowledge is. So I was really interested in how that would change over time. The performance lasted 23 hours.
Wow.
And then I really was spent. Like, I couldn't do it. But I started the performance at a 24-hour sleep deficit. So I had already been up for 24 hours when I started. So by the time Well, it was a big long fiasco of, like, I was in Germany, and we had gone to Kassel to see Documenta and didn't get back in time, and, you know, I had
another... Bad planning, in other words. Missed a train.
Yeah, it was kind of, like, long story short, it was bad planning.
Yeah.
And I had hoped to have, like, a good night's sleep before the performance and, like, start at my best, but instead I started... already totally depleted, and then continued, and it was very surreal and very rewarding and really amazing and harrowing to kind of experience trying to articulate what you think you know at a 50-hour sleep deficit.
Now, when you finish that performance and others, perhaps, but let's look at specifically this one. Are you on a high in a way? Or are you just completely wiped and, like, you are going to be sick for a week kind of thing?
Oh. With most performances, there's definitely a performance high. Absolutely. There's this adrenaline rush or endorphin, or I don't know physiologically what it technically is, but mm-hmm. it's totally addictive.
Yeah.
And it's really mind-altering. And I never do any... unnatural substances before my performances. I don't drink, I don't take drugs, I don't use caffeine. I really, like, it's very important to me that my body is just as it is. And that I experience it coherently and lucidly. But after the It's All I Know performance, I was so tired and so out of my body that I didn't feel the high in the same way that I usually do. I was definitely transformed. I certainly felt some sort of shift, and it was a very kind of philosophical, metaphysical awakening, strange sort of thing. And I will probably do that performance again. That'll be my second performance that I
repeat. I'm curious how that manifests on a practical level. Like, once you survive the hangover of it, you know, is it something you can quantify?
No, that's the point, right? I'm really interested in how you can't, like, the aspects of art or performance or knowledge that you cannot quantify at all. It's this phenomenological thing, right? It's just, it's about having experienced it. And certainly none of my viewers experienced anything like what I experienced. But almost every viewer that actually engaged with me clearly had a very different experience, depending on what time of day they came to me and what kind of personality they have in terms of how willing they were to engage or not engage or listen or how long they would listen. Someone listened for over 2 hours.
That's impressive.
And it was in the middle of the night, like it was 2 or 3 in the morning.
Wow.
Did
you have conversations with anybody as you were doing it, or did people just listen?
I kind of had conversations. I maintained the performance the whole time, so the performance was about everything that I know. And so if someone came up to me and wanted to engage me or started asking questions, I would respond to them, but with the phrasing, I know that, you know, I am standing here. So someone would say, what are you doing? And I would say, I know that I am doing a performance in which I recite everything that I know. So I tried to, it was always still part of the performance. And for the person that stood there for a long time, I started talking to him, but using third person, so I'd say, I know that there is a man standing in front of me, and I think that he must be an artist, because nobody else would stand there for 2 hours. And I thought, you know, and I would see him respond, but he didn't actually engage me in any conversation. And he left me a note at the end of it before he left. Which was really nice, yeah.
So I feel intimidated by your resume of profound experiences, you know, having done this podcast. But anyway, I just want to throw that out there. Get that insecurity out of the way, but otherwise, how do you feel about things?
About things in life or things in the podcast?
Things with this conversation, in particular.
Good, yeah. I think those are really good questions.
Thank you. I think this has been a combination of a lot of fun and very intense as well.
Oh wow! Yeah, thanks. I like that. Fun and intense is good.
Thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you.
And we're out.
Okay, bark!
Hey, it's me again. So that was just a reference to Klaus, Nicole's dog, who had barked in the middle of our conversation, but he sat on her lap for the rest. So anyway, that was a great exchange. Am I right? Was I right? Thank you again for listening. Do the Facebook thing, do the Twitter thing, whatever else. You can find the podcast on iTunes or other non-proprietary formats, including Podomatic, the Conversation Artist Podcast, .podomatic.com. You can download and stream there, and so on and so forth. And thank you again. I will talk to you later.